Tuesday night edition of the pod. We're going to finish out the 15 and 60. Got eight teams here to get to in the Western Conference. Where would you like to begin, Mr. LaRue? Which team's research are you most excited to talk about?
I'm trying to think about where would be a good place to start. I'm sure there are people who are interested in the drama of Golden State. So let's all start with that game, which was Clippers Warriors. But let's start with the Clippers. I think that's a more interesting place to begin this. They are now 8-5, 4-3 since the last time we covered them here. Plus 3.8 net rating puts them 8th in the NBA. They are 7th in offense, 14th in defense, 538 projections. Finally separated them from the Spurs because the Clippers won on Monday night and the Spurs lost. So that puts them 41 wins and 10th by themselves. For me, there were a couple of big takeaways from the Clippers side of their win, their overtime win over the Warriors. And one of them was just another really strong game for Montrezl Harrell. Came off the bench, but scored 23 points with 8 rebounds and 4 blocks in 32 minutes. There was overtime, so he played more and got obviously more stats because of that. And he just really changed the game. I thought that the energy he played with, the activity he brought, he wasn't fouling too much. You know, he did commit a couple that I thought they could have, that he didn't have to do, but he does really give them a boost. And so I think part of the reason the Clippers traded for Marcin Gortat was that, while I'm guessing they liked Harrell and Boban, they probably thought they needed more. And the answer is they're getting more from those guys. And so Gortat has been not entirely, but mostly marginalized.
Yeah. And Harrell, I think, you know, he dominated the Warriors in that game when Lou Williams had the 50 in Oracle last year. I think Lou and Harrell are tough matchups for the Warriors. Although, you know, as you know, you can talk more about this, that the ISO work with Lou down the end, as the Warriors went on an 11-0 run to tie it in the last few minutes, didn't go as well. And then it did go better off of free throws in the overtime. But yeah, I mean, Harrell's energy is really awesome. I think the biggest thing that Doc Rivers, if he's not starting him, has to watch out for is just making sure that he gets him enough rest, because he's going to be closing a lot of these games at this point. So, you know, he can't come in and play 18 straight minutes, do, you know, the old Nikola Mirotic. So I think that's something that they're really going to have to watch out for as well. I mean, I think in the Bucks game, he played like the last 18 minutes of the game, you know, which was another great win that they had with Lou Williams finally beating Eric Bledsoe, who had defended him well throughout most of the game, for an impossible floater in overtime. Do you want to talk about a little bit what their late game offense looked like against the Warriors, though?
Their late game offense was basically give the ball to Lou Williams, see what Lou Williams can do with it. And in regulation, that absolutely didn't work. I think it was a 22-5 Warriors run, and the Clippers missed, I believe, their last 11 shots from the field in regulation that game. They were getting to the free throw line a little bit. And then it worked better in overtime, partially because something that had happened earlier in the game was that the Warriors just didn't do a good job of defending Lou Williams without fouling. Kevon Looney early in the game, and then at the very end of the game, got caught just not really knowing how to play him. Once it was a reach that Lou Williams went through for a shooting foul, he's been doing that for 10 years. And also later on, both Iguodala and Looney bit on pump fakes, got into the air. Lou Williams got shooting fouls. I think both of those were 3-shot shooting fouls off of it. And, you know, you could live and die by Lou Williams to a point. But what was bothersome to me, and yes, the Clippers won the game and everything else like that, was I think they can do better. This is not last year's team where Lou Williams was the deserving sixth man of the year, was the alpha and the omega for their offense for a reason, because he was their best offensive player. He was their only good one. Not that Tobias Harris and Gallo had particularly good games, but I think they should have turned to them a little bit more. I thought Shea had a nice performance as well, and it worked. I think they could have, if they had gotten a few more points in the second half of the fourth quarter, they wouldn't have needed overtime in the first place.
Yeah, that would have been helpful, although certainly, you know, Gallo, Tobias Harris, those are kind of ISO type of players, you know, if you're going to quote unquote go to them, or they're going to need to work off of screens with the Warriors switching everything late in the game. You know, it is difficult to get those guys involved, and they're not going to necessarily have the matchup against a Warriors team, especially with Steph Curry out. It's hard to find that matchup. I thought their defense was pretty good in this game against the Warriors. You know, granted that this isn't a Warriors team that is that dynamic without Steph Curry there. You know, Klay Thompson got really hot late, but overall took 31 shots to get to 31 points. KD was held to 10 of 24 from the field to get to the foul line a fair amount, though. Anything else you wanted to talk about from that game? I had done a little bit of work on Shea that I wanted to get to here. It is not necessarily a full breakdown, but one that... Oh, actually, can you talk about what their defense was like in that game a little bit more?
Well, I think that they were largely, forcing guys like Durant and Klay Thompson to take tough shots. They weren't really stretched as far due to the Warriors not having Steph Curry. And that was actually one thing I disagreed with Doc on in this game, was that I understand the logic of not wanting to play Boban against Golden State because of the ways that you can attack him. But without Steph Curry on the floor, especially because Quinn Cook had a rough game, Patrick Beverley just smothered him when they put that matchup on the floor. And I thought Shea switched around the matchups on who was guarding Klay. I thought overall, especially in the first three quarters, he did a very good job. But there aren't that many guys on the Warriors other than KD who are really going to exploit you one-on-one when Steph Curry's not in the game. So I think the Clippers just kind of relied on their guys a lot more. And then they were generally had another guy at the rim if somebody got past, but the Warriors weren't getting much in the lane anyway.
Yeah, Boban is really interesting. I mean, as you mentioned, they did start Gortat, and Gortat actually wasn't too bad. This is one of his more efficient games in a while. I thought it was also interesting that the Clippers got up so few three-point attempts. They're only 5 out of 20 in this game.
Well, I will mention that a couple of those got taken away because Lou Williams got fouled on three-pointers, yeah. So unless the shot goes in, those don't count. So I think it would have been like 23 or 24, because there were like 22 or 23. There were at least a couple of those. Because I should mention that. Lou Williams, 5 of 18 from the field, 1 of 5 from 3, but 14 of 14 from the free throw line.
Now, there still are some fluky aspects to this Clippers defense statistically. They are allowing, or they remain second in the NBA in field goal percentage defense, and then they're in the 20s in all of the other categories. So the prediction last time we talked about them was that their defense was going to regress.
Well, can I get a stat on that? So right now, they're giving up a below average make rate on threes, but the bigger question mark for me is at the rim itself. So their foul rate is pretty high, but they're also giving up the third highest attempt proportion at the rim, 40%. Of opponents' half or shots are at the rim, and right now they're seventh in rim defense, let's call it. And it's possible that their rim protection is that good, but I don't expect it. I mean, just when I they do often have somebody there, but I'm not saying they're not the Clippers. I had not at that point yet where I was very skeptical of that last year with Nurkic, and I was like, oh, they're not gonna do that. But he's a different type of player than Harrell and Boban and those type of guys. So I expect them to not be atrocious at that, but if you're giving up that high a frequency and that low a success rate, if one of those regresses to the mean, most notably the shooting, then that will make the field goal percentage go up a lot.
Another interesting thing about this team, when we did their preview, you expressed some concern that their free throw rate might go down a little bit from last year, because I think last year they were number 4 in the league, if memory serves, in free throw rate. Well, they're 3rd this year, and we saw obviously getting to the foul line is what won them that game against Golden State. But that 5 out of 20, those 20 attempts, that's not an aberration. This team does not shoot a ton of three-pointers. They are 28th in the NBA in three-point attempt rate right now, and a year ago they were 23rd, so a similar profile. And actually they were 2nd in the NBA in free throw rate a year ago, although that number can change a little bit depending on who you consult. So that's looking like what this team is going to be. And you have, of course, guys like Gallo, Harrell, Lou Williams, Boban gets fouled all the time. They have a lot of guys who get to the foul line on this team. And, that's really important for them, especially in an era where teams get fouled far less. Now, if they got into a playoff series, it would be interesting to see how well that held up if teams are really locking in on what they try to do drawing fouls, particularly Gallo and Lou Will, because those are some of the craftier guys trying to draw fouls. Real quickly here, what I want to talk about with Shea, just has been awesome out of pick and roll. He's 10 out of 18 on pick and roll jump shots off the dribble. And when teams have gone under on him, it's interesting. This is a per synergy. He has not taken any jumpers out of pick and roll from three. You know, he's spotting up, taking some. He's looked okay on those shots, but not very aggressive yet shooting that. But when teams have gone under on him and he's able to get to a two-point jumper, he's been able to convert on that. He's 4 out of 5 on those plays. And then he's getting to the rim a pretty good amount. I mean, if you're talking about pick and roll, he's taken 19 jumpers off the dribble in pick and roll, and he's taken it to the basket 15 times, and he's finished quite well there, 8 out of 12. So that's a very good ratio, especially for a young guard, to be able to get to the rim that much out of pick and roll. All right, much more to get to here, but I want to tell you about a new sponsor. One of the sponsors that I've probably been most excited by, it's called GOAT.com, and it is the safest way to buy and sell authentic sneakers online. Apparently, there are a lot of fake sneakers out there, but GOAT makes sure that the sneakers that you are buying are authentic. They've made the whole process frictionless by only accepting sellers with the best reputations, and they verify all sneakers match their exact factory specifications to ensure authenticity. I always have a call with whoever the sponsor is before we accept them onto the show, and so I asked them, like, oh, well, what is your process like to ensure this? They're like, well, actually, like, a pair of new Jordans has a certain smell, and so we actually have people who know the industry smell them to determine, like, whether they are authentic or not, and they inspect every detail beyond that, as you might think, you know, the stitching, the color, the size, the weight. I mean, there's really a lot of things that you can do to determine whether a shoe is for real or not. They've got 500,000 sneakers on the platform available, and they have 10 million users, so you're going to find great prices there. They also have this program called Goat Clean, which involves reconditioning shoes. You can get a great price on that. If you go on their website, they explain the painstaking process that they go through there. The way to get started with them is at goat.com, GOAT.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about it all the time on the program. Definitely want to go right now before the sneakers you want are gone. I actually found, and also what was cool about them too, is just searching through there. The search engine is really easy. They'll give you a lot of suggestions as well. I mean, I'm not like a huge sneakerhead, but, you know, I see stuff that I like and buy it. So I'm not really particularly well versed in this, but there are so many shoes that were available that I'd never seen before in stores, and I ended up buying a really nice pair of Reebok Kamikaze 2s, which are what Sean Kemp used to wear. Anyway, I'm not going to keep talking about this because I'm sure there a lot of you are much bigger sneakerheads than I am, and I'm just going to sound like a moron trying to discuss this intelligently. But the site is pretty awesome. That's GOAT.com/capspace. Once again, GOAT.com/capspace. And do it now before the sneakers you want are gone. All right, let's turn now to Golden State. Unclear still when Steph Curry will return. They are doing the Texas Triangle with a 3 games and 4 nights, and they actually have 5 games this week. They're also playing tonight against the Hawks. If I had to guess, I don't think we will see him on that trip. You know, there haven't been reports of him doing a ton of full speed stuff. He's never had a groin injury before, so they've specifically said they're trying to be cautious with it. Now, there's talk that Curry would be, you know, in the MVP race, you know, missing. It'll end up being, what, 7 or 8 games here, Danny? Probably not going to help him too much with that.
Yeah, though Harden missed time due to a hamstring issue last year and still won. So, I mean, it is possible, but we could see how strong the cases are. The cases could be stronger for his competition this year than they were before. And the Warriors did get some reinforcements back in their loss to the Clippers. Livingston had missed some time due to a foot issue, and Draymond Green as well. Both those guys came back. Physically, I think both of them were fine. And then Draymond figured into both the comeback in the fourth quarter and then the bizarre ending to the fourth quarter when he grabbed a rebound. I had it in my head about 5 seconds. It's marked on the box score, the play-by-play, as 3.3 seconds. I think that might have been when he, like, controlled it.
Yeah, yeah,
like
it was that. It was definitely and earlier than 3.3 seconds. That's right.
Yeah, I think it was 5, 6, 5, something in that range. And so, generally speaking, the Warriors had 2 timeouts left. That is a time, it's too short to push it and go no timeout, because you're spending all the time getting up the floor. And even if it was a great pull-up shooter, I generally would think that at about 6 seconds, you'd still want to call the timeout. Green did not call the timeout. Kevin Durant very vociferously wanted the ball, which also was a mistake. I also should have been wanted a timeout, especially because Durant wasn't moving towards the basket. He was just kind of standing there. And then Green just takes it himself, drives into just a a forest of Clippers and doesn't even get a shot off before it before time expires. So it goes to overtime. The Warriors lose in overtime. Durant fouls out. Everything else that happens, and there is, you know, reporting of a conflict. There is a little bit more color on Tuesday afternoon from Sean Strania that might be a little bit more substance to it. But generally, my assumption as somebody who's covered this team for a while is that most of these things are just heat of the moment. You know, guys thinking that they had the right answers, and until we get something more substantive, that's just the way I treat it. Kind of like the I'm not a robot thing a few years ago and numerous other ones.
Yeah, well, Shams reporting that in the midst of the verbal exchange on the court late in Monday's game, Draymond Green challenged Kevin Durant about Durant's impending free agency. Ooh, that's not a good thing to do. I would think, KD is definitely not trying to hear that at this point. But I mean, I thought, and then apparently what caused further issue was that when Green was confronted not only by Durant, but by several teammates, even in the locker room after the game, that he wasn't like, okay, my bad, even though he did in fact turn it over, but that he also was like defending himself. And I think he pretty clearly was in the wrong for a number of reasons. I mean, one, they should have called timeout, and Kerr probably deserves the most blame there. Now, we're huge fans. I mean, going back to 5 years ago when very few teams did the no timeout strategy, you know, I was saying, hey, more teams need to do this. The math is just totally in favor of it. But 6 seconds left just isn't enough time. So, I mean, I appreciate the default of going quickly, but especially off a scramble rebound like that when you're not even inbounding the ball, I think it's just too difficult to get the ball up quickly enough. But then also Draymond, he's not, with that little time left, he's not the guy to be pushing it up because he is not a threat to take that shot off the dribble. He's not really a threat to get all the way to the rim and finish. There isn't really even time to get all the way to the rim and finish. And, you know, KD is one of the best guys pulling up from deep. Draymond also has a little bit of a history of kind of flubbing up these late game full court ball handling situations. You remember the play against Houston in game 5 last year is one of them. There was this one. This wasn't a full court situation, but in 2016 at home against the Celtics, you know, he kind of just was trying to attack off a pick and roll and lost. I mean, he's had like a number of kind of ugly turnovers in these situations. And while his confidence is appreciated, you know, there comes a time when you got to just, you know, give the ball to Steph Curry or Kevin Durant or Klay Thompson, who also felt that he was open on the play. And Green obviously ended up losing the ball. So, no, I think that is a my bad. Should have been a my bad by Green. We'll see. You know, both Green and Durant did not address reporters. Durant actually dressed. He's usually, if you're in the locker room, will just take forever to get ready. He addressed and left without even addressing reporters. And Slater said that he's never done that in the whole time that Slater has covered him, even going back to Oklahoma City. And then Green also did not address the media. So there's actually, you know, the fact that this is Woj is reporting stuff, that Shams is reporting stuff, like this is a little bit beyond what we've seen so far with these guys. Supposedly there wasn't anything regarding like a physical altercation or anything like that either. So at least that's a positive, but that's probably enough on that. I mean, we usually don't get into all this, like, you know, he said type of stuff on this show, but because it is something where he can be a free agent and also it has a basketball component to it that started this. I mean, I do think at least it's like, this isn't like, oh, these guys hate each other. It's actually like a basketball thing, which I think is something that's, you know, a little bit less worrisome that it just stemmed from, hey, you made this decision on the court. I don't know, what else do we got on these guys, unless you wanted to add something on that?
I don't really have much to add. Outside of that, Alphonso McKinney is coming back to earth a little bit. I mean, overall, his season stats are still going to regress. I mean, 48% on threes so far, and, you know, the 55% on twos, he can do better than that. Still rebounding the ball well, all of that. And then Jordan Bell, it was funny, because, like, I do the report card stuff for The Athletic, and I praised what he did on this play, where he had just come into the game, ran the floor really hard. I think it was Harrell that he beat down the floor, got a dunk in transition. I wrote, like, that's basically what he needs to do whenever he's on the floor. And then he never came back in the game. He played 2 minutes at the, I think it was the end of the second quarter, never returned. And while I thought Looney had a solid game overall, Damian Jones was eh. It's just strange to me that Kerr and the coaching staff have set this kind of preference ordering that is so strong when the players themselves have been a little bit more inconsistent than that. And maybe that's trying to instill confidence in Damian Jones or something like that or whatever, but I think Bell has a higher ceiling than Damian Jones as an overall player, just because his mind for the game is so much better. Yeah, he doesn't have the same size, but I think that matters a lot less in the modern NBA. And it's surprising to me. And generally when that happens, you always assume there's something, you know, something you're not seeing. And I openly acknowledge that that could be the case here, but I still want to acknowledge it because that's what we do.
Yeah, Damian Jones isn't good. He superficially had some moments the first four games of the year when they just happened to have a bunch of big centers to go against. But, you know, I think it's the numbers with him on the floor still, with as dominating as this team has been this year, have not been very good. Did we give all the fundamentals for them?
We might not have. I'll do that now. 11-3, 5-2 since last 15-60. Still first in net rating, plus 12.5. Still first in offense, 10th in defense, and 538 projects them to have 64 wins, which would be best in the West and the NBA entirely.
Also, that game against Brooklyn was just completely ridiculous in terms of their mid-range shooting. Like, they actually stuck with where they've been as an offensive team, even without Curry in that game, because I think they were 13 of 18 from mid-range in the first half, and just shooting incredibly well from mid-range and just getting up absolutely zero three-point attempts. I think they had like 5 3-point attempts in the first half of that game.
Quinn Cook made a bunch of mid-rangers.
Yeah, Cook played really well in that game. Didn't play as much in this one. You mentioned he struggled against Beverly. Let's talk Memphis Grizzlies now. They sit at 7-5, 4-3 in their last seven. They are 12th in the NBA with a 2.0 net rating. They are the 22nd ranked offense and the second ranked defense, projecting still for 35 wins. And remember, which would put them 12th in the conference. Remember, of course, that 35 wins is based not only on how they've played so far this year, but also the preseason expectations. That number two ranked defense obviously is what's made them so good, but to get that high is dependent entirely on the fact that they're forcing turnovers. And opponent turnover percentage is a relatively stable stat around 15 games or so. I was talking about Christian Narsu's research on that, just kind of how long it takes before you can draw some conclusions from a stats. And he said 15 games really for opponent turnover percentage, and they've played 12 games now, so certainly they're going to continue to be a high turnover forcing team. However, they're forcing turnovers at 19.1% of opponent possession. Last year's number one team was 16.5%, and the highest in the last 5 years over a full season was 2014-15 Milwaukee at 18.2%. You remember that was the first Jason Kidd year. And over the last 2 years, the highest turnover forcing team was around in the 16s. So they clearly are going to regress to some degree on forcing turnovers, and there's nothing else really that stands out about them defensively. You know, the field goal percentage, rebounding, fouling, that's all middling or below. It is worth noting that they are giving up the most percentage of shots as corner threes. Part of that, I think, is because they played the Jazz three times. The Jazz take a lot of corner threes. But 9.9% of shots they're giving up as corner threes, and opponents aren't shooting that well on them. So that's something to watch if they keep giving up a lot of corner threes. I think that generally it wouldn't surprise me this if teams that give up or force a lot of turnovers also give up a lot of corner threes, and probably shots at the rim as well. I mean, you'll remember that Bucks team that forced a lot of turnovers was similar there. But this team has a lot of guys who force turnovers. I mean, Kyle Anderson is probably the best guy in the league at poking away a dribble, especially because he's so slow. Guys like think they're going to blow by him, and then he's able to get that 7'4 wingspan and poke the ball away. And I think another reason that they've looked so good is just they don't have any bad defensive players who get minutes on this team.
Yeah, and that was why investing in the perimeter rotation was so important, because they getting guys like Garrett Temple. I mean, Garrett Temple is a solid operator on both ends of the floor. Conley is also buying in. I mean, it helps that they're so competitive this year. Gasol is looking a lot better. But yeah, the bench players too. I mean, Jaren Jackson, I think, has held his own. And really, you can go top to bottom with this squad. And they are going to face a challenge with that now that Dylan Brooks is out. Not that Brooks is an amazing defender, but getting into Marshawn Brooks and who I consider.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess he's the one guy in the rotation who's not any good. You're right. I'd forget.
Yeah, and he's going to have to play a lot more. Brooks is out 6 to 8 weeks with this grade 2 MCL sprain. So presumably he will get in that. And we'll have to see how Jermichael Green defends when he gets back, because he's obviously going to be a big part of the rotation. I don't think he'll be bad, but it'll just be something to evaluate once he returns. I haven't heard a specific timeline. I'm guessing another week or two. That kind of seems like, from what I remember, was about a month when he got hurt. And that was at the very beginning of the season. And something else that I think is interesting with how they've handled it, I talked about how deep their perimeter rotation is that Memphis is playing Mike Conley with Shelvin Mack a fair amount.
Yeah, they're doing that. And the numbers there have been okay. I mean, I think that makes sense because they're a little light on ball handling. You can bring Conley off some screens, do some more DHO stuff when you have another ball handler there. I think we'll see more Wayne Selden now with Brooks out. He's actually having a nice start to the season. He's 13 out of 27 from three. Brooks, we may not see, or Marshawn Brooks, we may not see as much of him because his shooting hasn't been quite as hot from three, although he is shooting 57% from two. He was just crazy when they signed him last year on two-point jumpers as well. I mean, he's not a guy who gets to the rim a ton. I don't think they're actually going to miss Brooks that much. I mean, he definitely plays hard, but I actually like Selden better than him. I'm also actually a little worried when Green comes back from that broken jaw of what that's going to mean for their offense. He's really not that great of an offensive player. He doesn't shoot enough threes, and he's not quite as athletic as he used to be. I mean, I think, frankly, that Jackson is better than him already in most ways, although Jackson is only 5 out of 27 from 3, which is a little bit of an issue. I think Jackson has more length than him, and he's going to need to play. I think Kyle Anderson is probably better than Green at this point also, although Anderson is, shall we say, struggling offensively. He's taken only 5 three-point attempts all season, made one of them, and yet he's still shooting 41% from the field and not hitting his free throws either to the limited extent he gets there. So we'll see whether they can continue to get anything out of Anderson as in terms of just the numbers when he's on the floor, which have actually been fine. And as I mentioned, Mac is having a pretty good season so far by his standards. 62% true shooting, which I'm not going to pull up his stats, but I'm pretty damn sure would be the best of his career. 18% usage, which is pretty high for him as well. Now, a lot of what he's doing is based on 47% three-point shooting. That's going to come down, but they are getting more out of him than they ever thought, and that's part of why they moved on from Andrew Harrison. Anything else that's popped out to you about them? I know you watched that game they played against Utah on over the weekend.
I'll talk a little bit about the Jazz side of that. The one other thing I want to mention that Memphis did that we saw more in person, though it was absolutely true in their game against the Jazz, is how good they are fighting over screens. I mean, that's something they just do a really good, especially Conley. Like, they just get through stuff, and that helps make the defense work and puts a little bit less strain on Marc Gasol. And it's a challenging defensive strategy. Like, there are a lot of, the reason why many teams have moved away from that is because a lot of guys can't pull it off, but they have, still have some of the personnel they can.
Yeah, and with Marc Gasol, I mean, you're never going to be in a switching system, and Gasol's defense has taken a big step forward from last year, when it does seem that perhaps he was just a little bit disheartened by how poorly things were going. I want to talk a little bit more about Jaren Jackson too, since we did see the Grizz in person about a week ago. He does post up really hard at the charge circle, and they can get those plays on high low stuff with Gasol. When he does catch the ball down there, he's going to go right shoulder to that left-handed jump hook every time. But when you're so close to the basket, that doesn't matter. You've already got the guy pinned pretty well. You don't need to have a ton of moves at that point. But it was interesting seeing Draymond Green guard him, because Draymond always knows the scouting report on everyone. And if you can only do one thing, he will always be sitting on that. And, he knew that Jackson is either going to just go a straight line drive to his left and try to get to that lefty hook shot, or if he ever does go right, he's going to spin back left. And so Draymond stripped him one time when he tried to go back to that. He knew exactly what was coming. And it was really, Jordan Bell was all over it too. Bell has started to get to where he's pretty good at taking away one-handed players. Bell blocked him a couple of times, got bailed out by a pretty weak foul call another time. We've seen Domantas Sabonis start to make some strides in his third season, but Jackson clearly, it was comical how many times he was going left and how far the Warriors were sitting on him. And he ended up having a decent statistical game in that game. He had 5 blocks and scored some points. There was a lot of garbage time late as well, but when the Warriors had any kind of decent defender on him, they were all over what he was trying to do. So he's going to really need to diversify there. I'm just not sure that he's ever going to be much more offensively as a one-on-one guy than someone who can attack mismatches with his size, and they continue to just not use him at all for three. He had 1 three-point attempt in that Warriors game, and it was a totally improvised play where he popped out to the corner. They're not running anything to get him threes. They're not having him stand out there at all. And granted, 5 out of 27 isn't going to be much of a plea to shoot more of those, but do you think, just quickly, we've watched a lot of Grizzlies games lately, what do you think of the job that JB Bickerstaff is doing as of this point,
getting his players to buy in and execute defensively? Well, execute is also interesting because you're talking about how their defense is so turnover based, and that is sometimes it's hard to sustain at the level they're at. It might be impossible to sustain at the level they're at offensively.
But I don't feel like there's a ton scheme wise that, like, you know, they're gambling a ton or like they're putting, you know, crazy defense on like pick and rolls or anything. I think a lot of it is just they have guys who are good at that, you know.
Yeah, they have guys that can do that. Kyle Anderson's a great example, without sacrificing in the way that some players, like I think of Monte Ellis always for this, like guys that there's certain guys that are high steal guys who are giving away a lot when they don't get the ball. And I think Memphis does a much better job, kind of like Boston, I would say, is another team like this, that those teams like 2-3 years ago that were generating a ton of turnovers, that they weren't sacrificing positioning and everything else. Offensively, I haven't been particularly impressed with them overall. I mean, it's still fun to watch Conley operate. I've been a big fan of his for probably like 4 or 5 years now. You know, I wasn't a huge fan when he signed that contract, but then it looked so much better in time. And so I'm kind of mixed on Bickerstaff at this point. I am very interested to see what their offense looks like as they kind of change some of their personnel over, because not only will they get Jermichael Green back, but presumably at some point Chandler Parsons will be available again too. So will they be better offensively and worse defensively? Will they be worse offensively? I want to see that. But I think he's been better than I expected, but I had a low bar, so I'm not going to say, oh, he's been awesome or anything like that, but I am happy with how they're defending.
Without looking at their stats, would you care to guess who leads the Grizzlies in steals per game? We mentioned that they are at least among players who have played more than 50 minutes.
Steals per game.
Yes. And also in steal rate. Actually.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so it's both. I'm gonna go with Anderson. I don't know why I'm going with Anderson.
It's a good guess.
Well, I do know why,
but it is Marc Gasol. Marc Gasol is averaging
he does a really nice job of dealing with in like attempted entry passes and stuff. I've noticed that, like, just because he knows positioning and he knows angles so well, that he can sometimes get a hand on those. He had a play like this. I'm trying to remember which of their games I was watching recently. I cracked up because it's such a great, like, veteran big man play, guy who does a lot of kind of handoff stuff. He just put his hand right in the middle of the handoff and just knocked the ball out. And it's like, yes, it's not exactly a risky foul situation. He just knew exactly where the ball was going to go. Just put his hand right there and then hit the mesh point, and the ball knocked out. And I think it was like Seldon grabbed it or something like that.
Yeah, he has 23 steals and 10 blocks on the season. That's crazy for a seven footer. A little concerning that he's only shooting 42% on twos. You know, his post up game has not been particularly effective. All right, that's enough on them though. That was good. Let's get to the other half of these teams that have now played three times already this season. The Jazz and Grizz. Oh, so that, yeah, I was wondering why you made that noise. It was just because they played each other again so quickly.
Well, and all of those games, it's not necessarily that they're poorly played. It's just that they're absolute slogs. Like, that's just, it's kind of what those teams want to do. You enjoy them. I do not enjoy them. Like, I mean, I enjoy that there are teams that are executing defensively. And, you know, I whether we're talking football or we're talking basketball, I enjoy quality defensive play where it doesn't feel like it's luck when the other team misses a shot or turns the ball over. But the way that both of these teams can be ground down offensively by a good defense means that these games are tough to watch from that perspective. And also, yeah, playing three times in the first 3 weeks of the season. So it was a stat. I tweeted out how it was angry, and for whatever reason, autocorrect changed one word. But the Jazz now, after their game on Wednesday against Dallas, they will have played 14 games. They will have played 14 games, I think. And six of those games were against either the Mavericks or the Grizzlies, because Wednesday will be their third game against the Mavericks. It's insane.
Well, maybe this is part of the price that we have to pay for having a little more time in between games, that it doesn't get to be spread out.
I think, like, There's also, I openly acknowledge that there are a lot of challenges with scheduling, and, you know, you're balancing road trips and availability of venues and all that type of stuff, but it should be a goal, maybe not a requirement, that teams do not play each other more frequently than every 3 weeks. Because a lot, like playing a team three times in 3 weeks, if, you know, a player is hurt, or like even in certain cases, like there was a thing with the Rockets, a suspension, like that is a disproportional effect on the season, even though they play 82 games. It's a small thing. thing, but it's something that is somewhat important to me. But where I want to start with the Jazz, it's kind of on this game, though I don't think either one of them was particularly huge in this one in a positive way. But I've been surprised by some of the lower end rotational stuff for this team. So
did we do their fundamentals, by the way?
No, thank you.
Wow, I can't believe I'm the one reminding you.
I'm excited to talk about the Jazz. 7-6, 3-4 since last time we did this. They are 13th in net rating at +1.8. Identical 12th in offense, 12th in defense. And 538's projections put them at 52 wins, which would be third place by themselves. And so before the season, my expectation was that the Jazz rotation would be somewhat straightforward. I mean, you have their starters are the same as the end of last year. And then they have Jay Crowder, Dante Exum, and then probably Tabo and Royce O'Neal. Like, Tabo missed a lot of last year, and then Royce O'Neal came on in his stead, but both those guys can play together. And instead, we've seen more of two guys that is notable. George Niang. George Niang has played in all 13 of Utah's games. He's only playing 8 minutes a game, but he's played in all 13 games, taking twice as many threes as twos. And I think I had the number that he's shooting like 44% on threes so far. And then the other guy is Alec Burks. Burks came on late as well, and he's been in the rotation too for the most part. I think he's played in like 9 of their 13 games, and I think he missed a little bit of time, as Burks does. And he's played more. He's played 16 minutes a game. And so with Tabo, I remember that he had this suspension thing, and so he missed 5 games. It was anti-drug policy, I believe. But since he came back, like, he was eligible again before the end of the month, and he has played a total of 9 minutes this entire season, and none in the last 3 games.
Yeah, and you would have thought that maybe he would be the guy getting those backup 4 minutes rather than Yang. I think they might want to consider that, because they just have not been able to stop anybody when Gobert is off the floor. Although really the scoring has been the bigger problem, and so maybe that's why they're thinking, hey, we got to go with Niang here. Derek Favors has a -9.4 net rating. Niang has a -11.8 net rating, and I mean, the defense hasn't been terrible, but really the offense has been bad. And so they do go a lot to lineups where, you know, they don't have any of their primary creators on the floor. I think they are still extremely reliant on Donovan Mitchell's creation, Ricky Rubio. So, I mean, their numbers are kind of messed up because Rubio has missed time, Mitchell has missed some time, but it definitely seems like the lineups where they have Favors and Yang together are not quite working on either end of the floor. Gobert, though, I mean, I think they've looked great when he's been out there. He's the best net rating on the team, 8.6. And overall, I mean, you mentioned the 12th ranked defense. Well, with Gobert on the floor, obviously, it's much better. And, you know, I think that they're going to get better than that. And so I think really if they could maintain this level of offense, the offense has been a relatively pleasant surprise so far. I think the defense would get better if they can hold on to these gains they've made offensively. And their shot profile is very good. You know, they're getting a ton of shots at the rim. Gobert's a huge part of that. He's averaging 1.6 points per possession as the role man. He's in the top five in terms of most role man possessions in the league, which is very encouraging when you're being that efficient. And then they're getting up a lot of three-pointers still too. So as long as you know, their lineups with their best players on the floor are really good. Their closing lineup looks really good. You had the stat on that. They're +19 net rating in 112 minutes with Crowder in place of Favors at the four. So I think everything's fine here. I think, you know, 7-6, people are a little worried. You know, they're 3-4. They haven't been able to win at home, but I think it's going to work out fine for these guys. I think they're going to get better defensively. They might regress a little on offense, but not that much. And, you know, if they're a top five defense and, you know, they're in the top half the league in offense, I think they'll be right about in the low 50s, where we kind of thought that they would be. You thought they'd be a little higher, but I think they're going to be in the mix for that number two seed in the West. I mean, that's going to be a really, you remember when we had like second best team in the East, we were like a couple years ago, we were like going crazy about that. I think this year will be who's the second best team in the West will be something we'll be monitoring all year.
It's not only who's the second best team, but also with records, both those dynamics, especially when you consider how strong the Nuggets started and how shakily the Rockets started. Like, it's going to take time for those things to adjust, and teams will go on runs and falter and all that. Something else briefly I want to mention, and this will come up in defensive player of the month conversations later on. Utah opponents are taking 36.5% of their shots in the restricted area when Rudy Gobert is off the floor. That 36.5 drops to 28.4 when he's out there. And those shots go to floater range and they go to mid range, which are significantly less effective shots. Also, generally, they draw less fouls and the free throw attempt rate is also lower when Gobert is on the floor. So he is just such a transformational player. And something, this will be something we talk about later on, that Dennis Lindsay and their front office needs to figure out is, I mean, their best lineup is their closing lineup, which is Crowder at the four. And what does that mean for Derek Favors and for their concept of what the power forward slash backup center role should be with this team? Because Utah has a lot of flexibility moving forward, and so they can go in different directions. You and I were both critical that they didn't go after somebody like Nemanja Bjelica in the offseason. It would have been nice just to have that as another option. And so how they conceive of what this team needs most is going to be extremely important, even if we're penciling in Gobert, Donovan Mitchell, and probably Joe Ingles, who also, we should mention, the gauze band. He busted open his right above his eye in the Grizzlies game. I think it was in the fourth quarter. And it looked to me like instead of putting the headband on like Klay Thompson got during his three-point record game, they just covered his head in gauze. I think it was more nuanced than that, but that's what it looked like, and I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, Joe is he's a pretty tough player. A lot of Aussies are. And you mentioned just real quickly the structure of this team and what it's going to be going forward. I mean, this is in some ways a still kind of a consolidation year. I mean, there really weren't that many. Bjelica might have been one, but there really weren't that many options available this offseason to make big upgrades. You know, they wanted to bring back Exum. You know, there wasn't really anyone else they could have gotten instead of Favors. But, you know, a big part of why Favors is being paid as he is because, you know, in certain matchups he can be in the closing lineup, like against OKC, but generally he's not going to close games. The reason he's being paid like he is so that he could be a force as a backup center and give them a lot there. But if they're not playing well with him on the floor as a backup center, you know, that's going to be something to monitor all year. If he can't give them quality backup center play, then that big salary, that $16.5 million non-guaranteed for next year, you know, becomes a lot less palatable, because I do think that they ultimately can't reach their ceiling with Favors and Gobert together against a lot of teams, although, you know, maybe it'll get better as it did at the end of last year. Let's turn now to Minnesota. 5-9, they did win their first game of the post-Butler era against the Nets. 2-5 in their last seven. Their negative 6.6 net rating is 25th in the NBA. They sport the 13th ranked offense and the 30th dead last ranked defense. Still projected for 42 wins by 538, although I'm not sure if that's been updated for the Butler trade or not, because there still was the projection from last year, and Butler was one of the best on-off guys in the league. Where I want to start with them is just the fantastic article that Shams and John Krasinski wrote about the whole Butler situation. They went through a timeline. There are a ton of really interesting goodies in there. TheAthletic.com/capspace is where you can sign up for that. Get an awesome discount. And, you know, John has just been doing fantastic work throughout this entire time. And one of the things I'm really liking about The Athletic now is they've got this huge network of reporters, so they're able to blend local and national reporting. Like, for example, on Danny's piece about Victor Oladipo, they're able to actually have reporters in every locker room go in and talk to the principals there about, you know, what they thought about the fact that he, you know, wasn't going to be eligible for the designated player veteran extension. And with John and Shams, I mean, this was, you know, probably like a 2,500 word piece. I mean, it's the exact type of stuff you get at The Athletic, this deep reporting that's not just something that you're going to see on Twitter. It's not just a little newser. Like, they're actually breaking news in a long form type of way that also, like, is a pleasure to read and provides additional color and detail. So once again, theathletic.com/capspace is where you can sign up for that. Support our show, support Danny's work at The Athletic. So, Danny, what were some of the more interesting pieces to come out of that reporting for you?
All of the pieces that I'm going to mention here are all things, and we'll probably talk about them as they come in, are all things that I personally, and I've been following this reporting, as so many of us have, not only in the podcasting world, but just in the basketball world. And these were all things that I didn't know the full range of or didn't know at all. So the first one in the piece was clarification that Jimmy Butler had made at least three other overtures to Thibodeau that to say that he didn't have a long-term future there. You and I actually talked about this on our trade rapid reaction podcast, that like basically for us, that would have been treated as a trade request if we were general managers. So in May, July, and August, that happened. So that's the first important piece. And then that ties in with the second one, which is that in mid-September, Glenn Taylor is surprised at the situation with Butler and Thibodeau because he didn't know that this whole thing had been happening. And so what we have here is a failure to communicate to a significant degree, especially considering what ended Taylor's outsized role in the eventual negotiation.
Yeah, Tom Thibodeau's ostrich approach with Butler didn't end up working. It's clear. And, you know, there's sometimes when, whether it's because of people being afraid of their jobs, whether it's because of just the nature of those people themselves, that, you know, when something goes wrong, you don't tell your boss, right? You're like, well, hey, if I fix this, he'll never know about it. Well, you know, you didn't fix it. You weren't able to fix it. And so now you come in, like, had Glenn Taylor known that, and he has been in this situation before, most obviously with Kevin Love, right? I mean, this is the exact situation. Kevin Love said, hey, I'm in the last year of my contract. I'm not planning on returning here. And Glenn Taylor, which, you know, in he has many flaws as an owner, but at least one thing that he's been willing to do is to say, hey, if this guy's not going to resign, we have to get something for him. We have to do it now. And at least then they wouldn't have gone into this season with this total clown show, which apparently has cost them like a ton of fans as well. I mean, they really were heading in the right track, and now they're 29th in the NBA in attendance, and like they have to do all these specials to try and get the fans in. And that's not really working.
And also this gets into this idea that there's been cover given to Thibodeau and Layden by some people, fans, some media people as well, that, oh, this was the best offer they could have gotten. Yeah, it probably is the best offer on the table in mid-November, but if Jimmy Butler had been on the trade market July 1st, or let's say draft night, I am confident they could have gotten something better than this. Because then you have him for the whole summer, you get all those other elements in play, and because at that point, teams are figuring out their rosters. When you try to trade with teams that are already set, that have already sold themselves on their guys, that have a lot less payroll flexibility because all those players can't be traded, it makes sense that the offers were constrained, and that when players like Josh Richardson play well, they go off the table, and that's more common than guys getting put on the table.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I mean, we could just continue it in chronological order here. What else then came out of this article that just was remarkable to you?
So 3 days after the other Taylor part, it's the Board of Governors, and there's a cool little story about that and teams going to Taylor and asking about Jimmy Butler, and Taylor tells them to approach Thibodeau and Layden and then to come back to him if they don't get anywhere. So when teams do that, Layden was answering the phone call saying Jimmy Butler was off limits and they weren't going to trade him. So it doesn't take a lot to have to circle back when your owner is saying, hey, talk to them about a trade, and then the general manager goes, this guy's not on the market for any reason.
Oh man. So by 9:23, a package centered around Goran Dragic, Justice Winslow, who remember at this point had not been extended, and a draft pick. We're not sure what draft pick. I would assume that means a first rounder. Now, the Wolves had a bunch of point guards already. I don't know how interested they were in Dragic. And then, however, at a later point, the deal that when they exchanged the medicals and everyone thought the deal was done became a package centered around Josh Richardson and a future first rounder. Again, we don't know the protections on that. Probably would have been like lottery protected or something. And probably would have included bad salary going back. There's speculation as to whether that was Olynyk, which wouldn't have actually been that terrible. He would have been a much better backup center for them than Jang, even though Jang obviously is being paid quite handsomely, and they wanted to get off of him. That was never realistic to do that, and at least if they wanted to get much in the way of assets back as well that are actually going to help the team win. And or maybe it would have been Dion Waiters, who again, you know, would not have really helped them even when healthy, I don't think, you know, and is looking like real bad salary. He's got 3 years left at over $11 million per season. But nonetheless, we said at the time, if you can get Josh Richardson back, Josh Richardson, frankly, might be more valuable than Jimmy Butler, even at that time. And that's before he started to break out a little bit this season. I mean, let's not go crazy that he's broken out quite this much. You know, this is only, you know, an eighth of the season so far, but, you know, he certainly has done enough, I think, to make it so they wouldn't want to trade, include him in any package for Butler. And I completely agree with that stance. I wouldn't have wanted to do that either. I think that it seemed like a very fair deal to me at that time. And considering how little leverage they had at the time to even get a deal that you'd think of as fair is pretty good. So they should have taken that one. Tibbs' quote yesterday in the first presser after the deal was, We knew we had to be patient. Once we got the offers to a good point, we executed the deal. More accurately, he could have said, once we got the offers to a good point, we continued to wait even longer and eventually took a worse deal. Because that's what they did.
So the next fascinating part of this to me was a couple of offers that I just never knew were on the table. And it's often that you don't hear about this. And they were reporting in there also that the Bucks kicked the tires. I mean, lots of teams, I'm sure, kicked tires on Jimmy Butler. He's an awesome basketball player. But the two substantive ones that were new to me that were in his reporting, or in their reporting, John and Shams, were New Orleans offering Nikola Mirotic and an unprotected first, and then Houston, a different proposal than the oft-discussed four first-round picks, Eric Gordon, Nene, and two firsts.
Yeah, and that's interesting because part of the reason why that four first-round picks, I think, was a non-starter, other than the fact that, you know, Tibbs wants to win right away, and what good does four first-round picks do me, other than, you know, being able to flip for other things that could help you win right away, in theory.
$20 can buy many things.
Exactly.
Oh, many peanuts. Yeah. Damn it. Yeah. I got it. It got it close to right. Damn it.
But anyway, so this one wouldn't have included any bad salary. I mean, again, we don't know the protections on those picks. It's Houston. You know, they're supposed to be pretty good. But, you know, I mean, they've kind of dropped off a little bit here. You know, let's say that's two lottery protected first rounders from Houston in, you know, probably it probably would have been this year, and then 2021 it probably would have been the two picks. 2021, you know, that lottery protected first could have been something that could have gotten into the teens potentially, depending on how Houston evolves. Do you like that package, Gordon and A and two first rounders, better than the one they eventually got, which was basically Šarić and Covington?
It's close, because Gordon has this year and next under contract, then he'd be unrestricted, you know, kind of like Covington, except Covington's contract is a little bit cheaper and then longer, which is important. And the first round picks, again, it depends on their protection, but I think I would go slightly for the Covington and Šarić one, just because if those picks were protected, as I agree with you that that's a logical assumption, I think there's a little bit more value there. But Eric Gordon's an intriguing fit. Nene, if they could eventually find a taker for Jang, is there. So I think that's a respectable offer. So I would have picked the one that they chose, but it would have been a close call.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the big reason why they would want to go with Covington and Šarić is just you get much more team control. Where you're able to Covington under contract for three more years after this one, Šarić two more years on his rookie deal, and then he's able to be a restricted free agent. You can bring him back. You know, a lot of it's on what do you think of Šarić? What do you think he can be? I'm probably lower on him than many. And, you know, I mean, I think Gordon and Covington, at least as far as how good they are right now as a watch, I think maybe you could say Covington's a little better fit because they just don't have anyone who can defend on the wing. Right now, Gordon, though, with his deep three-point shooting could be different. But, you know, I think some of Gordon's creation ability would be wasted on this Minnesota team. He and Covington make pretty close to the same money. Gordon's a few million more per season. And then, you know, he expires after next year. So I think, yeah, that's kind of six of one, half dozen the other. You would have to know exactly which draft picks, which protections to figure out which one would be better there. The Nets also apparently got involved with D'Angelo Russell, Rondé, salary filler. You know, I like this deal that they got better than that. And then there was one from New Orleans.
What I think is interesting.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. What I think is interesting about the Brooklyn one is the fact that even though I would do that for Jimmy Butler in a heartbeat, D'Angelo Russell being floated in a trade and is somewhat notable considering he's a pending restricted free agent with that gargantuan cap hold. So maybe they're a little bit less wedded to him, which I would support. And also them treating Caris LeVert and Jared Allen as core foundational pieces is significant from a team building perspective. I'm not sure necessarily to these negotiations, but yeah, let's get to New Orleans. The New Orleans offer was reportedly Nikola Mirotic and an unprotected first round pick.
Yeah. And Mirotic doesn't help him much because he's going to be an unrestricted free agent after this season. Unprotected first rounder. I'm guessing that would have been this year's, and New Orleans is looking like they're going to be pretty good. So I don't think that that's really quite in the same ballpark as some of these other ones. Although Mirotic, you know, certainly could have helped them this year. But I mean, really, the best thing for them to do right now probably is tank. Frankly, they're not going to do that, obviously. But that's I think they're just, you know, I mean, maybe they'll win a few games here and can get back to 500 over the next couple of weeks. But I think that seems pretty unlikely. I don't see their defense getting any better than it was without Butler, even if he wasn't playing the best here. So, all right, that's probably enough on the Wolves for now. We'll obviously be able to lock in more on how they're playing 2 weeks from now in the post-Butler era. You mentioned New Orleans. Let's turn to them now. 7-6. It's been a roller coaster ride for them. They've had some massive wins, some blowout wins. AD has missed time. He looks like he's finally back to playing well now. They had a stirring 126-110 win in Toronto on Monday night. And one thing that I was surprised by was that they held Kawhi Leonard to 7 of 20 shooting. So I wanted to go through and take a look at all of his shots and see how it was that they did that, because in theory, this is a team that has been killed by big, strong power, or I'm sorry, small forwards. You know, Kevin Durant always has been key among those. And they started actually with Wes Johnson on him. Wes played 21 minutes, didn't do much offensively, but does give a little more size. And I thought that when Kawhi tried to ISO on Wes, Wes did a pretty decent job. But the big key to me here was Anthony Davis, right? Like, Kawhi was 7 out of 20. He was 1 out of 5 in the half court at the rim. And on his four misses, Davis was in the vicinity on each of those. One of those, he didn't jump at all, and Kawhi just kind of missed it. But he definitely was still feeling the presence of Davis because he rushed that one in particular. They did put a lot of Jrue Holiday on Kawhi as well, and I thought Jrue at least tried to make him work, although Kawhi missed a fair number of mid-rangers that I thought were very solid looks that, you know, he's normally has a pretty good chance of knocking down. But it really, I mean, to take, if you consider that he's 1 of 5 at the rim in the half court, if he makes 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5 of those, then you're looking at an efficient night, or if he draws a foul on one of those plays. So it really a lot. And then AD switched onto him as well. Kawhi couldn't get anything going against AD on switches. He's 0 for 2 going at AD on switches. So I really give a lot of the credit to AD for Kawhi's rough night. Worth noting at least that Kawhi did get a couple of misses that were offensive rebounded immediately, you know, because he drew so much attention there. He also missed a couple open threes. So, you know, it wasn't 7 to 20 probably overstates the difficulty of shots they forced him into, but to the extent that he struggled, AD, I thought, deserved the lion's share of the credit there.
For me, one of the big just takeaways from this game, and this should not be a surprise, especially after last year's, the 2018 playoffs, Jrue Holiday was just awesome in this game. I thought that it was a reminder to me of the just shutting down and then offensive dominance against Portland in the first round last year. Lowry just was totally out of sorts the entire game, and you can point to the 1 of 9 from the field, sure, and he did still have 11 assists because Kyle Lowry can't fall out of bed in the morning now without getting a bunch of assists, which is a really interesting story. But just making shots hard, and it wasn't just Jrue though, because as you said, some of the time he ended up on Kawhi. I thought overall they did a really nice job defensively. And then as J.E. Skeets brought up on Tuesday morning, and it's been a kind of a weird thing they talked about in the broadcast, Etuan Moore, beyond having a good year overall, he's consistently done well against the Toronto Raptors, which is bizarre considering it's not like those teams have ever played a playoff series or anything like that. And I think he has like 15 and a half points per game in those last 5 games against them, and he dropped a 30 on them on 13 of 18 shooting, most of that from 2. He was 3 of 5 on threes and then 10 of 13 on twos in this game. And yeah, I mean, just a really nice game from Portland, that's the team they vanquished, from New Orleans starters in this game. And then their bench I thought was fine. They weren't, nothing knocked my socks off there, but they did well enough that Toronto's vaunted bench did not actually outscore them.
Yeah, and considering that Elfrid Payton remains out still with this ankle, that we didn't hear when it happened that it was going to be nearly this troublesome, but it sounds like he's finally getting somewhat close. And then Mirotić has missed 2 straight with a sprained ankle. They started Randall. They got some really nice minutes off the bench from Diallo, who gave him some energy in a little over 20 minutes. More, I mean, you know, it's funny that the Pelicans get a lot of shit for signing Solomon Hill, which, again, to be honest, it wasn't a contract that I hated at the time, although I always felt like he should be playing at the 4. You know, they signed him to play at the 3, and that seemed like a mistake. But, you know, and Hill got $12 million a year for 4 years. That obviously ended up being an overpay. Certainly his severe hamstring injury at the start of last year contributed to his not living up to that contract, although it's unlikely that he would have anyway. But Etuan Moore, to get him on a 4-year, $34 million deal, you remember that it was reported initially that Moore, who had a minimum cap hold and early bird rights with the Bulls could have offered him up to 4 years, $28 million, and kept his minimum cap hold on the books. And so the Pelicans very pointedly outbid the Bulls by going to $34 million. That meant that the Bulls would have had to break into their cap space. They were too busy signing Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade to want to do that. So the Pels got more, and he is easily, I mean, he's been a quality starting shooting guard for this team at under $10 million a year, hitting threes. He has one of the best floaters in the NBA. He was 5 out of 8 on floaters in that big performance. So I think that overall, when you look especially at some of the terrible contracts that were signed in the summer of 2016, the Pels, who were not really considered a premier destination at the time, even when you consider that Hill was an overpay, just getting more for the price that they did and having that be a quality contract from the summer of 2016 is so much better than the vast majority of other teams seem to do.
Yeah, you won't really have much of an argument from me. You ready to move on to the Portland Trailblazers? I think that's a good place to go next.
Yeah, we'll save the Suns for last because,
Save the last for save the least for last.
Yeah.
Portland, 10-3, 7-1 since the last 15-16. That might be a little bit screwed up by the numbers were a little bit weird in the doc for them. Plus 9.7 net rating puts them third in the NBA, which is great. Third in offense, fifth in defense, and 538's projections, which of course includes a lot of the preseason priors and all that. 47 wins, which would tie them for sixth. And a nice piece of news on Tuesday afternoon from Jason Quick that Mo Harkless looked good as he worked out on Tuesday. He's not all the way back, but his quote is, "I'm feeling pretty good about where I'm at." So he is an important part of what they do. I think they have missed him, even though they've been very successful in his stead. So excited for when that happens, though we don't know when that will be.
Yeah, they've had a ton of home games, but I've also had some really nice home wins, obviously. I mean, they beat the Bucks, who have been on fire. They beat the Celtics the other night, although the Celtics staged a comeback, but Portland largely controlled that game. The shooting at the rim from CJ McCollum, he was 4 out of 25 the last time we checked in on them, but actually 17 out of 28 since then, so that's a lot better. He has gotten 10 shots at the rim blocked so far. And then another statistical anomaly has finally ended here.
After a false start when Myers Leonard was credited with a block, which was then taken away, he actually got a block. I think it was in the next game, and it was his first since April 12th of 2017, the last game of the 16-17 regular season. Remember, Myers Leonard's a 7-footer who typically plays center, didn't block a shot, but he did get one. And, you know, I'm not expecting that he will be as consistent a part of Portland's rotations once if they're full strength. You know, if they get Harkless back, because then they can slide Collins back to his normal spot. You can get into a lot of these more normal situations. And even if they, whatever they end up doing with Lehman, if they keep him starting, bring him off the bench, whatever. And we spent time in the last 15-60, I believe this was Liam's team last time, talking about Zach Collins. And that was justified. And Zach Collins is having a nice year. I've been happy with him so far. But the guy who's playing above him, who just signed a contract last season, Yusuf Nurkic, is having another good year.
Well, he actually disappointed last year. So he was great, obviously, when the Blazers got him down the stretch.
That's right.
2 years
yeah.
ago. And then last year, in a contract year, did not play well. It seemed like he was pressing a little bit, but was very inefficient. And through 13 games this year, he's looking a lot better. He's having an underrated season, 58% true shooting, which is not amazing for a center, but, you know, that's still quality offense, and 27% usage. As the role man, he's been very effective. He's 14th in the league with 41 possessions as the role man. And what's really been the most impressive is 17% offensive rebounds for Nurkic, which is just a ridiculous amount of offensive rebounds. You know, that's like a league-leading type of level, although I think Drummond is still ahead of him. Now, he's only 20 out of 38 on putbacks coming off the offensive rebounds. Now, some of those can just be kind of tips where he just tips it off the backboard, you know, didn't really control it. But, you know, he's never been the greatest finisher around the rim. He has to get his body into guys. He'll flip it up early, hoping not to get his shot blocked. But he's 41st percentile at converting. And I mean, that's still quality offense that you're just creating out of nowhere by getting these offensive rebounds. He's already has 43 possessions as a putback guy. So that's almost four possessions a game there. And then the biggest reason why, you know, he hasn't been quite as efficient, he's only 8 out of 27 on jump shots. Interesting to note, though, that, you know, there hasn't been really hardly any pick and pop. He's mostly been rolling hard to the rim. He's only has four pick and pop jumpers, and he happens to be 0 for 4 on those. Where he's really taking the jump shot is on spot ups. I actually watched all of his spot up attempts to see, all right, is he just kind of jacking bad long twos here, or you know, how is his decision making? He has been taking a fair number of threes, just threes where he's wide open at the top of the key. And there's some who might say, all right, you're open for a reason. But at the start of the year, that's a shot that he's worked on. We saw that a little bit in the preseason. We saw it a little bit at the end of last year, as I recall. And if he's not being guarded there, I think it's fine that he takes, you know, one a game when he's just completely wide open. Because especially with all the DHO stuff that they do, it's good to have him have to be guarded out there so you can open up the rim. The other situations where he's been taking a lot of spot ups is when they do a DHO, his man backs off to try to prevent the guy from turning the corner, and then Nurkic just turned to the basket and be wide open. So there really were only, like, I thought, three or four of those shots that I was like, hey, you know, he's kind of contested. It's a long two, like, it was early in the clock. You know, he had to take a few late in the clock as well. So I don't really have that much of a problem, despite the poor percentage on jumpers. I don't think really too many of those are, like, terrible decisions. You know, most of his usage is coming from the offensive rebounding, pick and roll, getting into the post, and he's been pretty effective on those plays.
Another just little facet of the Blazers season worth noting is that when they let go of Shabazz Napier and brought in Seth Curry, I mean, we both liked the signing of Seth Curry, especially once we found out that there wasn't a second year player option. It was just a 1 year deal at a really favorable number. But the idea was always, oh, if they're letting Napier go, it was going to be kind of like in other years where they let a guy go and then somebody else rose and took their place within the ranks. That's what they did with Pat Connaughton and numerous other things over the last few years. Instead, that guy was Wade Baldwin. Wade Baldwin hasn't played at all this year. It's been Seth Curry. And I think Curry has done a good job. And that's, you know, the other way that you can solve bench problems is by actually signing good players.
Well, and I think it's really, we knew Curry was going to play. I think we anticipated that Curry would be the backup two and they'd go with Baldwin as the backup one. But really, it's been Curry as the backup one, but he's been playing in more of a shooting guard role. They've been giving Turner more ball handling responsibilities. And Nick Stauskas has been the guy who's played more. You remember he had that preposterous game early against the Lakers. I think that was on opening night. And he's dropped off a little bit. Obviously, you know, he has Nick Stauskas. We'll see how he finishes out the rest of the season. But Curry, his numbers in particular, when he's on the floor, have looked fantastic. He's got an 18.5 net rating. Now, a lot of that is 92 defensive rating. I'm not going to give a lot of credit to Seth Curry for that necessarily. But I still think that their decision, which was controversial, to not stagger Dame and CJ anymore, continues to be working really well. They're also getting decent minutes out of Jake Lehman. You know, he's been getting the Keith Bogans most of the time, you know, where he just plays the first 6 minutes or so of the first and third and then never comes back in. But I think he has given some balance to the rotation. Now, if Harkless is going to be ready to return soon, if he can get back to being effective, I think they probably want to just slide him in for Lehman in the starting lineup. But Lehman actually has been hitting his shots. I mean, that's been the big problem. He's been aggressive, looking to take the three. Pretty low usage, but at least he hasn't been killing them. You know, and I think that's, for a guy who was on the fringes before this year and hadn't hit shots, I think he's taken an important step forward in his career. All right, we can move on to Phoenix here. But first, this from Lending Club, whether it's unexpected repairs, medical expenses, credit card debt, sometimes a little money can make a big difference. You can get that money at LendingClub.com. They give you access to low rates on loans of up to $40,000 for almost any purpose. It's a lot easier than going to a bank, and they offer lower rates on high interest credit cards. You can find out if you're approved in minutes at LendingClub.com. You go there, enter the amount that you need. And again, it's so much easier than having to actually go in to the bank. And they're really quick too. If you find an offer that works for you, the money can be in your account in just days. For more than 10 years, LendingClub has helped millions of people with over $31 billion in loans. You can take charge of your finances today with LendingClub. The way to get started with them, go to LendingClub.com/capspace. /capspace. We talk about it all the time on the program. And if you go to that lendingclub.com/capspace, you can check your rate for free, and checking your rate will not impact your credit score. That's lendingclub.com/capspace. lendingclub.com/capspace. Let me know if that /capspace URL that you came from us. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Danny, the Phoenix Suns are on a historically bad pace so far this season.
Yeah, 2-11, 1-6 since last 15-60. Last in net rating, -14. Last in offense, 27th in defense. Projected to win 22 games, which would be last. And it is important to note, yeah, the -14 net rating is truly awful. With Devin Booker on the floor, including garbage time, I don't know how clean the glass separates it out, but they're -10.4 net rating, which is better than the -18 they are without him, but still not great. 102.4 offensive rating in his minutes. And again, that's suboptimal. I looked it up, and there are 11 players who have played, you know, similar or more minutes than him, and are 20 plus usage guys that have a lower offensive rating than Devin Booker. A lot of this is also having imperfect teammates, but you and I talked about it before the season that one of the definitive questions for the Suns, which is still not answered, is whether they need somebody else offensively with Devin Booker, like a point guard type guy, or whether he can shoulder the burden. We still don't know that for sure, but I'm leaning towards needing somebody else.
Well, they haven't tried that much with him at point guard. I mean, there is going to have to be, having only one person on your team who can run a pick and roll is tough, especially in the system that Kokoschkov wants to run. But clearly the point guards who are on the roster right now are not the answer. Okobo, Isaiah Kanan, I was always wanted to call him Kanan. He apparently now has just corrected the pronunciation that is in fact Kanan, like the biblical land, but people were pronouncing it Canon before this, which was weird. But in any event, while he deserves credit for making it back from that really ugly ankle injury last year, he has not shot the ball well. He's only in the low 30s on threes. And then Eli Okobo has been their main backup point guard. Big surprise, really young point guard from overseas, drafted number 31, isn't ready to give them quality backup point guard minutes. Their bench has just been absolutely miserable as well. Josh Jackson coming off the bench has a 2.5 PER, and he's only played more than 13 minutes once in his last six, and that was in a game that had a lot of garbage time in New Orleans. He was playing garbage time there. So I mean, with Booker and Ayton on the floor, you know, we'd express some optimism that with Ayton on the floor, they're only -4 last time we checked in. Well, that's down at -9 now. So with their best players on the floor, they're only like run-of-the-mill worst team in the league in a given season type of level, as opposed to like worst team in the last 10 years type of level, which is what they've played at overall. They also have, I mean, they've had a few games, you know, they had that Boston game they probably should have won were it not for a miracle comeback by the Celtics to get into overtime and then beat them in overtime,
and a foul that they should have made, which would have not assured, but pretty dang close to assured the victory.
Yeah And Kokoschkov said they were told to foul and they just didn't in that situation, when Marcus Morris had his back turned with under 5 seconds to go and the Suns up 3. So they've had some competitive games. You know, they beat Memphis for their only other win by 2 at home. Their first win obviously was that 21-pointer over Dallas on opening night. But yeah,
maybe we should just do more of their games for the NBA cast, because they have a 21-point win in that, and then their only other win is by 2.
We're not doing another one of the games to the NBA cast. They may not even be on national TV again, actually. And every other time that they're on national TV, like they were on national TV against the Spurs again this year, they got just, you know, they were down by like 30 at home after the first half. And that one, you remember last year, they had a national game against Houston and they gave up 90 points in the first half. We're not doing another one of those. And we're definitely not doing a road game of theirs, because they've been completely non-competitive. Like, they have a chance to be competitive at home, as we've seen, but on the road, their best result was a 7-point loss in OKC, and even that one was a game in which they were down by 25 and just came back in garbage time. Other than that, they haven't lost by less than 17 on the road, and they've played a home-heavy schedule as well. 8 of their 13 games have been at home, so when they play on the road, they just are going to get blown out.
There are some definitely encouraging signs for Devin Booker. I mean, the most important one are the shots that he's taking. So what you're looking for, especially with a young guy, and Devin Booker is still very young, to shift some of their mid-rangers to ideally shots at the rim, and if those go to shots at 3, maybe drawing some fouls too. And by and large, he's been doing that this year.
Yeah, the numbers are looking a little bit better. And like I said, I mean, I think they've found slightly better ways to use him in Kokoschkov's system. His turnover rate is up a little bit, as their entire team is. I mean, they're 30th in the NBA in turnover rate. That's a big reason why their offense has been so bad. I think they actually can get better on offense. I think they have better talent than, I mean, maybe they don't, just because of the point guard situation. Maybe that's what's really like holding them back. I mean, because that's like point guard,
kind of like the Magic the last 2 years, where maybe they have a lot of kind of more dependent talents that just need the activation.
Yeah, I think like Ayton could be an okay offensive center at this point in his career. Now, certainly the way Doncic has played, it's not looking very good for the decision to not draft Doncic number one. And God, if you think of Kokoschkov, like how much you would just be pulling your hair out over the fact that they didn't draft Doncic, especially if things continue to go this way. That number one, you know, you coached Doncic, you knew how good he was. I'm sure he suggested, even though he was new in the organization, that they draft him, you would think. And then you also have to like be pulling your hair out to try and coach DeAndre Ayton on defense every day, like as the result of them not listening to you. That's got to be pretty vexing. Few other notes on these guys. Mikal Bridges is the one guy in this team that they've actually played well when he's been on the floor. Somehow he has a positive 6.4 net rating, which is crazy considering how bad everyone else is. A lot of that is teams just shooting a lot worse, but the shot profile defensively is better for them when Bridges is out there on the floor. I don't know how much credit we can give him for that, but they are 15 points per 100 possessions better with Bridges on the floor defensively. And not all of that is due to just, you know, I think teams are shooting like 7% worse from three when he's out there, which, you know, I'm not going to say Mikal Bridges is the reason for that. But the one thing to watch for him, he has a disturbingly low rebound rate overall, only 8% defensive rebound rate. For a guy his size, he should probably be doing better there, although their overall rebounding isn't any worse when he's on the floor. And then a couple other small notes just for their rotation. Dragan Bender, I mean, I think we're getting to the point where they might as well, I mean, the only reason not to waive him is probably for potential salary matching at this point, because he's only played 14 minutes all year. And I mean, it's not like they haven't had garbage time for him to get out there and play in. Jamal Crawford signed there at the start of the year. He is now getting DNPs. There was no reason to sign him. That was pretty ridiculous. And you know, they ended up having to move on from a guy who I still think, you know, could be okay in Devon Reed. And Ryan Anderson just has not spaced the floor the way they wanted him to with the way he's shooting. He's at 7 of 30 from 3. At least Trevor Ariza is kind of back to his normal rate at 34%. But, you know, he really has not made a difference. And there's an interesting thought of just when you have kind of the pieces offensively and defensively to be like a decent team, someone like Ariza, I think, can really matter, right? Certainly you can argue that his loss has mattered a ton for the Rockets so far this year. And, you know, he's a good vet and he's communicative. But bringing him into this situation, which was just so bad to begin with, like his skill set, you know, a 3-and-D type of player like this, isn't going to matter as much when you're just like so far below the Mendoza line of even being competent as a team that someone like that can get lost. And this is why I think there are a lot of players like this on bad teams, I should say, that good teams should try to identify, because I think there's a type of player who, you know, is kind of the opposite of some of these high usage, a little bit more inefficient creationists, you know, your Carmelo Anthony's, your DeMarcus Cousins, maybe guys who, you know, offensively can kind of raise your floor a little bit, but then you get them onto a good team and maybe they're not efficient enough and they take shots away from better players. And so maybe they don't help you if you're a good team. You know, Ariza is probably an example of a guy who really can help you if you're a good team, but then if you're a bad team, you know, just can't really do enough to make much of a difference. So maybe there's something to be said for guys who are good on good teams and don't really help bad teams, as opposed to the type of players who help bad teams and don't really help good teams as much.
It's a very interesting point, and it's something that it would be fun to take some time to try to identify
and
Covington, some of those players moving forward.
Covington's going to be an interesting one too, going into Minnesota.
That's kind of what I was getting at. As a part of the, and Šarić to me as a dependent offensive player could end up being in that camp too. But Covington is a clear example for many reasons.
All right, I think that's all I've got here. I will look forward to seeing you at the game tonight, and we'll be back with a gamer and catch up on some news as well on Wednesday. Got a lot of good stuff on the schedule Wednesday. And then the NBA cast will return Thursday for Golden State at Houston, which is the early game, 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern. Follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/NateDuncanNBA. That's where we've moved over to now. Hopefully even have a new banner. That'll be really exciting. It says NBA cast on it. And we really look forward to interacting with all you guys doing that live play-by-play. If you haven't checked that out, I implore you to do so. We will talk to you all then.